Hi, everyone, and welcome to Tracks Through Time. I am your host and Freight Waves deputy editor, Brielle Jaeckel, and I am here to tell you about some of the most interesting stories throughout history in transportation and freight. But today, we have a story that spans both transportation and the world of mystery, followed by an interview with someone very close to the subject. So December of last year marked the 55th anniversary of the Silver Bridge collapse in West Virginia and Ohio. It's regarded as one of the deadliest bridge collapses in modern history. A minor flaw in one of the I-bars, number 330, that formed the suspension bridge caused it to fail. That I-bar had high levels of residual stress from its manufacturing, which caused water to pool at the bottom of the I-hole. Over the course of 39 years, a crack formed and grew until it was eventually 3 millimeters long, and temperatures in the area on December 15th, 1967 were near freezing, making the material of the bridge more brittle than normal. All of this caused the crack to grow almost instantly down to the outer edge. Witnesses recall hearing a gunshot-like noise at 5 p.m., according to the West Virginia Dot, and the bridge quickly folded into the Ohio River, bringing 32 vehicles along with it. 46 people died, and two bodies were never recovered. The horrible tragedy of the Silver Bridge, which was named for its aluminum color, set in motion a series of changes in bridge construction and maintenance. Almost 2 months later, on February 7, 1968, President Lyndon Johnson called for immediate reconstruction through a federal and state program. Additionally, the president created the National Bridge Inspection Standards used throughout the U.S. for all inspected bridges. The investigation revealed on April 6, 1971, the faulty I-bar was the cause. The event resulted in greater safety standards from a federal level being applied to all highway bridges. The incident of the collapse has long been discussed in folklore as well as transportation because it is a part of the Mothman prophecy, which is said to be a creature 10 foot tall with glowing red eyes and resembles a moth. The reason why this is connected to the bridge collapse is because sightings of the Mothman were rumored to be seen on the bridge in the weeks leading up to the collapse. The folklore of the Mothman says that he warns of danger, so many people are saying that he was warning everyone of the bridge about to collapse. But we also have an interview next with Tracy, who is an important part of the DOT in West Virginia, and he knows quite a bit about the bridge and the collapse and safety regulations following the collapse. So let's see what he has to say now. Hi, everyone. I am here with Tracy W. Brown, who is a state bridge engineer and he in West Virginia Department of Transportation. And he knows quite a bit about our bridge collapse, the Silver Bridge collapse. And we are interested in hearing what he has to say. Hi, Tracy. Thank you for coming on.
Well, it's nice to be with you. Nice to have an opportunity to talk about this tragedy that hopefully a lot of people involved in transportation can learn a lot from.
Right. So we know the story. I've given everyone the rundown of, you know, what happened, but I kind of wanted to hear from you. Can you describe that flaw in the I-bar and how the bridge collapse actually happened?
Yeah, actually, it was an I-bar on the upstream I-bar chain. And there was two towers, one on West Virginia side, one on the Ohio side. So this was past the Ohio Tower towards the Ohio shoreline. And, you know, there's a lot of different theories. They investigated that bridge a whole lot, as you can imagine, the National Transportation Safety Board, FHWA, and state of West Virginia, state of Ohio. A lot of people think it was a flaw that came from the foundry, you know, maybe a piece of an inclusion, what we call, in a non-metallurgical material. Of course, it was built in 1928, so the QAQC process for steel manufacturing wasn't what it is today, but there was a, more or less a crack that was an eighth inch or less in an I-bar that over time opened up. And it, I think I sent you a picture of the actual I-bar that fell. You know, on one side, it's a straight line, just like you cut it with a knife or something. And I believe that was the side that, you know, probably opened up, you know, and then once that gave loose, the other side is more jagged, which was more of a ductile failure. So I'm thinking probably that the I-bar, you know, actually fractured due to that inclusion. And then over time, it just ripped loose.
Can you describe the aftermath of what, of after, you know, after the collapse and there's chaos and then the weeks leading after that?
Yeah, it was very chaotic. And there was a guy I used to work for when I first got out of school that worked here at the West Virginia Department of Transportation. When that happened, he started in 56, so he would have been here 10 years. I used to pick his brain all the time. And I said, what was it like working there? You know, what was it like when that happened? He said it was a rough place to work at that time. And when he said that, I was wanting more information. You know, I was wanting details. But then as the years have gone by and I think about it, he probably said all he needed to say is rough time. And, you know, you can imagine this was, you know, 1967. Here in West Virginia, most of our interstates, early interstates, were being built about that time. The earliest sections of our interstates. So this was a U.S. route, U.S. Route 35, and it was basically the interstate of its day. And they actually called the Silver Bridge the gateway to the Midwest. And the gateway to the South, you know, if you're coming from the Midwest, and it was a heavily traveled truck route, you know, people going back and forth through, you know, different states and things. And so you can imagine once you sever that link, you know, it's hurting not only people trying to get from one side of the river to the other for work and to visit family and friends, but it's disrupting commerce too. So they were routing traffic off of US 35, from my understanding, as far west as Chillicothe, Ohio, and as far east as here in Charleston, where I'm at. So, you know, getting that many vehicles a day, you know, trying to move through and things. And so you had to bridge closed for 2 years before the new one was built. And they ran a ferry boat for a while. Goodyear had a resin plant down there on the West Virginia side, just south of Point Pleasant, downstream from the Silver Bridge. And they ran a ferry boat for a little while, actually ran a railroad before that, a dedicated commuter line, until they could get the river docks built for the ferry boat. So then they ran the ferry boat, you know, to my understanding, until the new Silver Memorial Bridge was built.
It's just crazy to me how it's, one, such a tragedy with the casualties that actually took place when it actually collapsed, and then the upending of daily life and commerce and, you know, freight afterwards, because it was such an important bridge and it took, you know, 2 years to fix. But it's interesting to see the different ways that they, you know, would go around it, you know, how to kind of keep life normal.
And the bridge wasn't known as a bad bridge at this, you know, until it fell. Nobody really thought a whole lot about it. It swayed and things like that. But based on its design, people were used to it. It always did that. So nobody can imagine it would have fallen. But they went through a lot out there, and every day that we come to work, I always tell, you know, our folks, you know, especially our bridge safety inspectors, you know, it's a tough job going up inspecting these bridges in all kinds of weather. The traffic's horrendous. Usually that's mostly the dangerous thing that they can face is the traffic. But I said it's hard because it's worth it. You know, we're doing this for a reason, to prevent that from happening, you know, to help prevent it from ever happening again. You don't want anybody to even have to think about how safe a bridge is while they're crossing.
Yeah, exactly. And that brings me to my next question. How did this change safety in bridges for Virginia and in the U.S. in general, but also why this specifically did it make such a difference?
Before Silver Bridge fell, we were mostly inspecting bridges with a mindset of what kind of maintenance needs does this bridge have? You know, they would go down, you know, and maybe it was somebody that was, you know, doing something completely different, maybe running a piece of equipment the day before. But they said, well, you're going in this area, look at the Silver Bridge while you're there and see what's wrong with it. And they would write down, well, you know, this has got some surface rust, you know, it needs cleaned and spot painted, maybe expansion joint leaking and things like that. But then when the Silver Bridge fell, it all became about safety. Safety is paramount. Safety is number one. So it got all the states and the U.S. territories and jurisdictions all on the same page. It standardized what a bridge inspection was, what that term meant. And it, you know, required the bridge safety inspectors to have certain credentials, certain training, meet certain standards. And it also required, you know, right out of the gate that the bridges, or that the states inventory their bridges, keep an inventory of all bridges and the data, you know, based on their condition and their geometry and so forth. And it's federal data that we submit every year on a yearly basis.
It kind of just brought in perspective the gravity of the situation, it seems like, yeah, of how important safety is, and not just like a quick overview, but really, you know, getting down to the nitty gritty to make sure things are safe.
Yeah. And of course, you know, for my life, I remember going through Point Pleasant the first time we were going on family vacation. I was a little kid, pretty young. And my dad said, this is where the bridge fell. And, you know, all those people got killed. 46 folks got killed here. And, you know, I thought, wow, you know, as a kid, how can that happen? But I think looking back, and you know, of course, I'm trying not to speak for the people, you know, that experienced life before Silver Bridge. But I believe, you know, there was kind of a mindset of, you know, it's never happened before. So it wasn't on anybody's front burner, so to speak, until it happened. And, you know, the infrastructure was getting older by that point. And, you know, prior to that, you know, even the Silver Bridge built in 1928, you know, what was it, 41 or 39 years old, I guess, you know, when it fell. So it really wasn't an old bridge, but our infrastructure as it got older, that, you know, I think that put the focus on what could happen. Unfortunately, it had to happen for people to realize that and
right,
come to terms with it.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, that's how a lot of change happens.
Yeah.
On to a lighter note, can you tell us a little bit about how the Silver Bridge became an American Society of Civil Engineers National Historic Civil Engineering Landmark? And what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, there's ASCE, which is American Society of Civil Engineers, has a landmark program, and it's really to highlight and put the spotlight on civil engineering landmarks that, you know, maybe are a good example of, you know, something that you know, a group of people achieved at some point as civil engineers, or something that you never want to forget. And most of these landmarks are, you know, things like the Hoover Dam and you know, things like that. We got a suspension bridge here in West Virginia that's a civil engineering landmark, and they can be state or national historic landmarks. So the ASC president here in our local area here in West Virginia approached me about, said, would I would I support that? And I said, oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I hadn't heard of it until that time that they had this program. So we put some documentation together and got our governor and Speaker of the House here and our Senate president to all support it, the mayor of Point Pleasant and some of the locals in that area down there to, you know, write letters of support. And so we went before a nomination committee and a passed unanimously, which I was very thankful for. From what I understand, you know, sometimes, you know, there's split votes on that. But once I found out what it was and you know, they had my support 100% because, you know, as new generations come and older generations retire and so forth, you don't want anybody to have to relearn this lesson by having to go through it again. You know, it's happened once, and so you want people, future generations, to remember this and to remember how important it is. I go back to, you know, the guy that I was telling you that worked here when it happened, when I first started working for him. He gave me a picture of the Silver Bridge, and it wasn't anything fancy. It was just something printed out with a thumbtack throw, but he said, and it was a picture of the Silver Bridge lying in the river. And he said, hang this on your wall so you can look at it every once in a while. He said, if you ever get to a Friday evening and you want to take a shortcut to get home early for the weekend, he said, look at that picture and said, just remember, there's no shortcuts. It takes time. You don't tell it how much time you're going to spend on a certain situation when it comes to bridges. The bridges or the design or whatever you're working on tells you how much effort and time you need to pay to it. So that was a lesson to me that, you know, what he went through, you know, he passed it on to me and I felt like it's been my duty and other folks here feel that way too, that we need to pass that on to future generations. You know, how important the work they do is and how due diligence needs to be paid. So they don't have to learn the mistake the hard way.
I was going to ask, is that because I know that you've been, you know, kind of an advocate for, you know, safety and you've been focused specifically. I mean, you're an expert on the Silver Bridge collapse. Is that what inspired you to kind of focus on this?
It kind of showed me that, you know, bridges are important. We rely on bridges. That's what I tell like our inspectors and our designers and so forth. I said, you know, if you stop at the convenience store to get gas on your way home, look around because everybody there has crossed at least one bridge. If you're in the supermarket or grocery store, everybody there's relied on at least one bridge more or less to get there. Probably most cases, multiple bridges. So the safety of those bridges is important. You know, we can kind of take them for granted as a society. And to be honest with you, if you're a citizen not involved in bridges in your job, you should never think about them. You know, you may look at them and think, well, it's a pretty bridge, but you should never think, was this bridge safe or is it not safe? I mean, if we do our jobs as bridge professionals, engineers, technicians, inspectors, and so forth, nobody will be thinking about bridges. They'll just cross them and use them, and they'll make their lives better and more convenient. But if you know, even if you get in a situation where our inspections are pretty robust and they'll catch, you know, critical deficiencies that, you know, we can kind of gauge and quantify how safe a bridge is, and we'll close a bridge before we put anybody on an unsafe bridge. But when you take a bridge offline, especially if it's in a urban setting or even rural setting, you know, you could detour traffic 70 miles or more to get around that. And everybody notices that. So we depend on bridges. And because we depend on them so much, you know, they need to be safe for everybody.
Yeah, I'm now putting in perspective. So I live in on the Jersey Shore and I live on the mainland, but I have to go to the island like a couple times a week. And we only have one way to get to the island. There's that bridge and that bridge is it. And yeah, you definitely take it for granted because they replaced it And it was a 7-year project. And we were all so, can they hurry this up? Like, this is like a disaster. You know, they're doing construction in the summertime because that's when it's warm out where they can actually do construction. But that's when our tourism like spikes up. So we're all just like complaining about this. But in hindsight, it's like, no, like they need to, yeah, take their time and make sure everything's safe. I can't even imagine if that bridge was gone, what we would do.
Yeah, it's a life changer. And a lot of times now, which is a small, you know, I truly believe it's a small percentage of the people. But if you hold them up 30 seconds, go off somewhere, they let you know about it. But
yeah.
But the vocal people are, I don't think, the majority. You know, most people, I think, hopefully appreciate what these guys do and these ladies do to keep them safe. You know, I mean, we can't lose track of that. That's the reason we're there, is to maintain that bridge or roadway or whatever we're working on, to, you know, to make sure it's there for people to safely use and this service.
Right. So I know that there were sister bridges to the Silver Bridge that were identical. So what happened to them afterwards? Did any, you know, were any faults found? Did they have to take extra precautions with those bridges?
Yeah, it's interesting. We had a bridge, it was around 80 miles upstream, and it crossed Ohio River too into the state of Ohio. We called it the High Carpenter Bridge, and High Carpenter was a guy's name that ran a ferry boat there years ago before the bridge was built, I believe. And so they built this bridge. It was, I believe, built the year after Silver Bridge, maybe. I'm not sure about that, but I think it came a little bit after. And so they call it the High Carpenter Bridge, and it spanned from St. Mary's, West Virginia, into Newport, Ohio. And it was an identical bridge. The only difference was, I think, it had an approach span that was a little bit different because there was an island there, and you went across, and you could turn right if you're getting on the bridge and go down to this island. And that part of that structure is still there that goes down to the island. We've recently renovated it, when Silver Bridge happened, this was an identical I-bar style type bridge, and so they shut it down. And at that time, we were building I-77, Interstate 77, and I'm going to say 20, 30 miles downstream, and they were in the process of constructing that bridge over Ohio River, and they had a little bit of work to do, like guardrail and finish up work. You know, the bridge was mostly complete, and they kind of rushed that along as quick as they could, and they shut down the High Carpenter Bridge. And so around 1974, they dismantled this bridge, and from what I can gather, they sent those I-bars off for testing to see what kind of flaws they could find in those. But when the results came in, they got destroyed. And the thinking was that at the time, and I understand this, as bad as it is, it would be interesting to know, but, you know, the leadership at the time thought, well, what good can come out of knowing these results? We either just tore down a perfectly good bridge, or we have people on a safe bridge. And either way, it was kind of bad news. So I don't know that anybody ever knew the results of those I-4 tests were done on our. And there's another bridge that was built similar to this, with the same design concepts, in Florianapolis, Brazil, southern Brazil. And one of my coworkers, actually, he was down there on vacation here a few months ago for a trip, and sent pictures back of that bridge. But it was a sister bridge, and it's still there, and they've renovated it. And to my understanding, you know, they've retrofitted those I-bars. They've either put additional I-bars in to make it more structurally redundant, where, you know, you'd have other low pass if one were to fail, or maybe they use cables. I'm not really sure. I never went back and checked, but it's still in service, and it was shut down, you know, to traffic for a long time. But from my understanding, this renovation, it's open to traffic, and it's in, you know, South America.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine being, you know, working on that bridge or having anything related to that bridge right after the Silver Bridge collapse. I mean, closing it, I def would assume is definitely a good decision.
Yeah, I know, like, when events like that happen, you know, sometimes, you know, like Minneapolis, when that bridge collapsed, you know, of course, it had its own set of issues. But, you know, everybody kind of got nervous about deck trusses. And so we inspected all of ours, you know, which we do anyhow, but we went out and took a special look at them to make sure that that particular thing that went wrong with that one, a gusset plate, we didn't have any issues here, and we didn't. But, you know, our inspection program now, we've got non-destructive testing methods, and these inspectors go through, you know, all kinds of training, and it's not just training that you get done with and you work the rest of your career. You've got to take, training periodically throughout your career. So they got to stay up to date on this. And I think, you know, most problems, you know, we find problems sometimes, and luckily the inspection program allows us to catch those problems early enough that we can do something about it.
Well, I'm running out of time here, but I do just want to ask one important question that I think, I mean, it's at least been on my mind. I know we've seen a lot of things happening in transportation, but mostly related to infrastructure. Some, I don't want to say disasters, some are disasters, some incidents. A lot of stuff is related to infrastructure in the United States. I mean, it happens all over the world. But in the U.S., how can we change the way we handle infrastructure to be safer, you know, to kind of prevent these things from happening?
Yeah, I think for a long time, our issue was funding. You know, it was like you were having all these needs and you never had the funding to keep up. And now a lot of the funding has broken loose and we're able to spend that. And I think the key to it is, you know, instead of building these multi-million-dollar bridges and walking away and letting it age and then replacing it 50 to 75 years later, you know, treat them like we do the Brooklyn Bridge or Golden Gate Bridge or our New River Gorge Bridge here in West Virginia, you know, maintain it. You know, they're just like a person. You know, if a person doesn't maintain themselves and doesn't take care of themselves, we'll start having health problems later on that's going to become more and more and more severe and more costly to treat. But if you've got a good bridge, you can do a little bit of work, not much at all, but a little bit of work and keep that bridge good. And I think that's what we need to do. I mean, it's cost-effective, the most cost-effective thing, and the taxpayers have a lot of investment in our infrastructure. And I think that's fair to them to keep our good bridges good and not let them get down into poor condition.
I think that's definitely a great sentiment that we can, you know, think of for highways, you know, railroads, all of that. I think that's a good strategy to have. But that is all the time I have for today. Thank you so much for coming on and talking with me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Very welcome. It's a privilege to be here. And I thank you for you know, giving me an opportunity to talk about Silver Bridge, because you never know when somebody may hear it and it may mean something to them and help down the road.
Well, we appreciate all the work you do in driving that safety, you know, regulations further and making sure that everyone's safe while, you know, being able to get on with their days.
Well, I truly appreciate that. Thank you a lot.
All right. Well, I will end today with our, unfortunately, not so fun fact of the day. Today actually marks the anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, causing one of the worst ecological disasters of history. You can check out freightwaves.com for more information about that. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter at Jacob Brielle to see what else we have going on at FreightWaves Classics. And you can email me at bjacob@freightwaves.com. Tune in 2 weeks for our next episode on FreightWaves TV, or listen to the show wherever you get your podcasts.